a property that's not ours. Plus, it's the principle of the thing.
But we live here, I whispered. And it looks so bad. My father studied me.
Juliana, what happened?
Nothing, Daddy, I said. But he knew I was lying.
Sweetheart,
he whispered.
Tell me.
I knew what he'd say if I told him. And yet I couldn't not tell him, not with the way he was looking at me. So I took a deep breath and said, The Laskys have been throwing my eggs away because they were afraid they'd have salmonella because our yard is such a mess. My father said,
Oh, that's ridiculous.
But my mother gasped, What? Then she cried, Did Patsy say that? I looked down. No, Bryce did.
But it must have been a family discussion. A boy doesn't come up with that on his own.
My mother looked for all the world like a doe waiting to be shot through the heart. She covered her face with her hands and said,
I can't go on like this. Robert, things have got to change. They've just got to. Trina, you know I'm doing the best I can. I'm sorry about the yard. I'm sorry about the situation. This isn't the picture I had for my life either, but sometimes you have to sacrifice for what's right.
My mother looked up from her hands and said,
This is not right for our family. Your daughter is suffering because we won't fix up our own yard. It's not our yard. How can you say that, Robert? Wake up. We have lived here for 12 years. It's not temporary anymore. If we ever want to have a decent place with our own yard, if we're going to help the kids through college or do any of the other things we've promised each other, we're going to have to move him into government care.
My father let out a deep sigh and whispered,
We've discussed this so many times, Trina. In the end, you always agree that keeping him at Greenhaven is the right thing to do.
I wanted to say, Wait, what are you talking about? Who are you talking about? But the conversation was flying so fast and furious that I couldn't seem to break in, and it wasn't long before they were bickering so badly that it was almost like I wasn't there. Then in the back of my mind, it clicked. Everything clicked. It was my dad's brother they were talking about. My Uncle David. To me, Uncle David was only a name. Someone my parents had explained to me, but not someone I'd ever actually met. And even though I knew my dad visited him, I never knew exactly when. He never talked about it. Dad also thought we shouldn't talk about Uncle David to others because David was retarded.
People jump to conclusions,
he'd told me.
They assume that by association, something must also be wrong with you. Trust me, I know.
So we didn't talk about it. Not at home, not with friends. It was almost like there was no Uncle David. Until now. Now he felt larger than life, and I could tell from their argument that he was the reason we didn't have our own house. He was the reason we didn't have nice cars or fancy things. He was the reason there always seemed to be a cloud of weariness hanging over my parents. Why did I have to bring up the yard in the first place? I'd never seen my parents fight like this, ever. I wanted to grab them and say, Stop it! Stop it! You love each other! You do! But I just sat there with tears streaming down my face. My mother stopped suddenly and whispered, We should not be doing this in front of her.
I'm sorry, Juliana,
my dad said, then reached over and held my forearm.
Don't cry. None of this is your fault. We'll work it out. I promise we will.
My mother tried to laugh through her tears, saying,
We always have, and we always will.
That night, my parents came into my room and talked to me, one at a time. My father talked about his brother and how much he loved him and how he'd promised his parents he'd always take care of him. My mother talked about how much she loved my father for his strength and kind heart, about dreams and reality and the need to count your blessings. And she made me cry all over again when she kissed me goodnight and whispered that of all her many blessings, I was her best and brightest. I felt sorry for my father. I felt sorry for my mother. But most of all, I felt lucky for me that they were mine. And in the morning, as I rode my rusty bike out the driveway to school, I promised myself that when I got home, I'd tackle the yard. Rented or not, this was our home, and I was going to help make living here better. As it turns out, this was easier thought than done. First, it took me half an hour of rummaging through the garage to find a hammer and a box of nails, a saw, and some pruners. Then, it took another half hour of standing around to figure out just where to start. The actual yard was just clumps of weeds, but what about the bordering shrubs? Should I dig them up or prune them way back? Were they shrubs, or just overgrown weeds? And what about the fence? Should I knock it down or rebuild it? Maybe I should take out the front end entirely and use the wood to fix up the sides. The longer I looked around, the more I felt like forgetting the whole thing. Why bother? It wasn't our property. Mr. Finnegan should be the one making repairs. But then I remembered my mother's words from the night before. Surely, I thought, a few bushes and some dilapidated wood couldn't stop someone's best and brightest blessing. Surely not. And with that, I picked up the clippers and got to work. Half an hour later, I was keeper of the knowledge that one bush equals many branches, and that the volume of a bush increases exponentially as it's cut and tossed into the middle of a yard. It was ridiculous. Where was I going to put all this stuff? Mom came home and tried to talk me out of my mission, but I'd have none of it. Oh, no, no, no. I'd already pruned two bushes down to a respectable size, and before long she'd see. The place was going to look just dandy. You didn't get that stubborn streak from me, she said. But came back outside with a glass of juice and a kiss for my cheek. Good enough for me. By the end of that first day, what I'd made was a big mess. But if chaos is a necessary step in the organization of one's universe, then I was well on my way. At least, that's what I tried to tell myself when I flopped into bed that night, dead tired. And the next afternoon, I was busily expanding the chaos of my little universe when I heard a deep voice say, "That's quite an undertaking, young lady." The man standing on our sidewalk was Bryce's grandfather. I knew that much. But I'd only ever seen him outside one time. All the other times I'd seen him had been through windows, either one in their sitting room or one in their car. To me, he was just a dark-haired man behind glass. Having him appear on my sidewalk was like having someone from TV step through the screen and talk to you.
"I know we've seen each other from time to time," he was saying. "I'm sorry it's taken me over a year to come introduce myself. I'm Chester Duncan, Bryce's grandfather. And you, of course, are Juliana Baker."
He stuck out his hand, so I took off my work glove and watched my hand completely disappear inside his as we shook. "Nice to meet you, Mr. Duncan," I said, thinking that this man was way bigger than he looked from the sitting room window. Then, the strangest thing happened. He pulled his own work gloves and a pair of clippers from a back pocket and said,
"Are you pruning all of these to the same height?"
"Oh," I said, "well, yes, that is what I was thinking. Although now I don't know. Do you think it would look better to just take them out?" He shook his head and said,
"They're Australian tea shrubs. They'll prune up nicely."
And with that, he put on his gloves and started clipping. At first, I didn't know what to say to this man. It was very strange to be getting his help, but from the way he was acting, it was as though I shouldn't have thought a thing of it. Clip, 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 he went, like this was something he really enjoyed doing. Then I remembered what Bryce had said about our yard, and suddenly I knew why he was there.
"What's the matter?"
he asked, throwing his clippings into my pile.
"Did I cut it down too far?"
No.
"Then why the look?"
he asked.
"I don't mean to make you uncomfortable. I just thought you might like a little help."
"Well, I don't. I can do this by myself." He laughed and said,
"Oh, I have no doubt about that."
Then got back to clipping.
You see, Juliana, I read about you in the paper, and I've lived across the street from you for over a year now. It's easy to see that you're a very competent person.
We both worked quietly for a minute, but I found myself throwing the clippings into the pile harder and harder. And before long, I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't stand it. I spun on him and said, "You're here because you feel bad about the eggs, aren't you? Well, our eggs are perfectly fine. We've been eating them for nearly 3 years, and none of us have gotten poisoned. Mrs. Stubbe and Mrs. Helms seem in good health to me, too. And the fact of the matter is, if you didn't want them, you should have just told me so." His hands fell to his sides, and he shook his head as he said,
"Eggs? Poisoned? Juliana, I have no idea what you're talking about."
Inside, I was so angry and hurt and embarrassed that I didn't even feel like me. "I'm talking about the eggs that I've been bringing over to your house for more than 2 years. Eggs that my chickens laid that I could have sold. Eggs that your family has been throwing away." I was shouting at him, shouting at an adult like I'd never shouted at anyone in my entire life. His voice got very quiet.
"I'm sorry. I don't know about any eggs. Who did you give them to?"
"Bryce." My throat choked closed as I said his name again. "Bryce." Mr. Duncan nodded slowly and said,
"Well,"
then went back to pruning his bush.
"That probably explains it."
"What do you mean?" He sighed.
"The boy still has a ways to go."
I just stared at him, not trusting myself with the words sizzling on my tongue.
"Oh, he's a very handsome boy. There's no denying that,"
he said with a frown. Then he snapped a branch and added,
"The spitting image of his father."
I shook my head. "Why are you over here, Mr. Duncan? If you don't think I need the help, and you're not feeling bad about the eggs, then why would you do this?"
"Honestly?"
I just looked at him, straight in the eye. He nodded, then said,
"Because you remind me of my wife."
"Your wife?"
"That's right."
He gave me a little smile and said,
"Renee would have sat up in that tree with you. She would have sat there all night."
And with those two sentences, my anger vanished. "Really?"
"Absolutely."
She died?" He nodded.
"And I miss her terribly."
He tossed a branch into the heap and chuckled.
"There's nothing like a headstrong woman to make you happy to be alive."
The last thing in the world I expected was to become friends with Bryce's grandfather. But by dinner time, I knew so much about him and his wife and the adventures they'd had together that it seemed like I'd known him for a very long time. Plus, all his stories made the work seem easy. When I went in for the night, the bushes were all pruned back, and except for the enormous heap in the center of the yard, things were already looking a whole lot better. The next day, he was back, and when I smiled and said, "Hi, Mr. Duncan," he smiled back and said,
"Call me Chet, won't you?"
He looked at the hammer in my hand and said,
"I take it we're starting on the fence today?"
Chet taught me how to plumb a line for the pickets, how to hold a hammer down on the end of the handle instead of choking up on it, how to calculate an adjusted spacing for the pickets, and how to use a level to get the wood exactly vertical. We worked on the fence for days, and the whole time we worked, we talked. It wasn't just about his wife, either. He wanted to know about the sycamore tree, and seemed to understand exactly what I meant when I told about the whole being greater than the sum of its parts.
"It's that way with people, too,"
he said.
"Only with people, it's sometimes that the whole is less than the sum of the parts."
I thought that was pretty interesting. And the next day during school, I looked around at the people I'd known since elementary school, trying to figure out if they were more or less than the sum of their parts. Chet was right. A lot of them were less. Top of the list, of course, was Shelley Stahls. To look at her, you'd think she had everything. But there's not much solid underneath her Mount Everest hair. And even though she's like a black hole at sucking people in, it doesn't take them long to figure out that being friends with her requires fanning the flames of a wildfire ego. But of all my classmates, the one person I couldn't seem to place was Bryce. Until recently, I'd have said with absolute certainty that he was greater, far greater, than the sum of his parts. What he did to my heart was sheer inexplicable magic. But inexplicable was the operative word here. And as I looked across the room at him during math, I couldn't help feeling crushed all over again about how he'd thrown out my eggs. What kind of person would do that? Then he looked my way and smiled, and my heart lurched. But I was mad at myself for it. How could I still feel this way after what he'd done? I avoided him the rest of the day, but by the end of school, there was a tornado inside me, tearing me up from one end to the other. I jumped on my bike and rode home faster than I ever had before. The right pedal clanked against the chain guard, and the whole bike rattled and squeaked, threatening to collapse into a pile of rusty parts. The tornado, however, was still going strong when I skidded to a halt in our driveway. So I transferred pedal power into painting power. I pried open the gallon of Navajo white my dad had bought me and started slopping paint around. Chet appeared about 10 minutes later. "My," he laughed, "you've got an enviable amount of energy today, don't you?" "No," I said, brushing back some hair with the back of my hand. "I'm just mad." He produced his own brush and an empty coffee can.
"Uh-oh. Who at?"
"Myself."
"Oh, that's a tough one. Did you do poorly on a test?"
"No, I turned to him and said, "How did you fall in love with your wife?" He poured some Navajo white into his can and smiled.
"Ah," he said, "boy problems."
"I do not have boy problems." He hesitated, but didn't argue. Instead, he said,
"I fell in love with her by mistake."
"By mistake? What do you mean?"
"I didn't intend to. At the time, I was engaged to somebody else, and in no position to fall in love. Fortunately for me, I saw how blind I'd been before it was too late."
"Blind?"
"Yes. My fiancé was very beautiful. She had the most magnificent brown eyes, and skin like an angel. And for a time, all I could see was her beauty. But then, well, let's just say I discovered she wasn't a fraction of the person Renee was."
He dipped his brush in the coffee can and stroked a picket with paint.
"It's easy to look back and see it, and it's easy to give the advice. But the sad fact is, most people don't look beneath the surface until it's too late."
We were quiet a minute, but I could see Chet thinking. And from the furrow in his brow, I knew it had nothing to do with my problems. I'm sorry I brought up your wife," I said.
"Oh, don't be. That's all right."
He shook his head and tried on a smile.
"Besides, I wasn't thinking of Renee. I was thinking of someone else. Someone who's never been able to look beneath the surface. At this point, I don't suppose I even want her to."
Who was he talking about? I wanted to know, but I felt it would be crossing some line to ask. So we painted pickets in silence. At last, he turned to me and said,
"Get beyond his eyes and his smile and the sheen of his hair. Look at what's really there."
The way he said it sent a chill through me. It was as though he knew. And suddenly I felt defensive. Was he telling me his grandson wasn't worth it? When it was time to go in for dinner, I still didn't feel right, but at least the tornado was gone. Mom said Dad was working late, and since the boys were off with their friends, it was just the two of us. She told me that she and Dad had talked about it, and that they both felt a little strange having Chet come over like he was. Maybe, she said, they should find a way to pay him for his help. I told her I thought Chet would find that insulting, but the next day, she went ahead and insulted him anyway. Chet said,
"No, Mrs. Baker, it's been my pleasure to help out your daughter on this project,"
and wouldn't hear another word about it. The week ended with my dad loading the back of his truck with all the clippings and scraps before he set off for work on Saturday morning. Then Chet and I spent the rest of the day hoeing up weeds and raking and readying the dirt for seeding. It was on this last day that Chet asked,
"Your family's not moving, are you?"
"Moving? Why do you say that?"
"Oh, my daughter brought up the possibility at the dinner table last night. She thought that maybe you're fixing up the house because you're getting ready to sell it."
Even though Chet and I had talked about a lot of things while we were working, I probably wouldn't have told them about Mr. Finnegan or Uncle David or why the yard was such a mess if he hadn't asked me about moving. But since he had, well, I wound up telling him everything. And it felt good to talk about it, especially about Uncle David. It felt like blowing a dandelion into the wind and watching all the little seeds float off, up and away. I was proud of my parents. And looking around the front yard, I was proud of me, too. Just wait until I got my hands on the backyard. Then maybe I'd even paint the house. I could do it. I could. Chet was pretty quiet after I told him the story. And when Mom brought us out sandwiches at lunchtime, we sat on the porch and ate without saying a word. Then he broke the silence by nodding across the street and saying,
"I don't know why he doesn't just come out and say hello."
"Who?" I asked, then looked across the street to where he'd nodded. The curtain in Bryce's room moved quickly back into place, and I couldn't help asking, "Bryce?"
"That's the third time I've seen him watching."
"Really?" My heart was fluttering about like a baby bird trying to fly. He frowned and said,
"Let's finish up and get that seed sown, shall we? You'll want the warmth of the day to help with the germination."
I was happy to finally be planting the yard, but I couldn't help being distracted by Bryce's window. Was he watching? During the rest of the afternoon, I checked more often than I'd like to admit. And I'm afraid Chet noticed, too, because when we were all done and we'd congratulated each other on what was sure to be a fine-looking yard, he said,
"He may be acting like a coward now, but I do hold out hope for the boy."
A coward? What on earth could I say to that? I just stood there with the hose in one hand and the spigot valve beneath the other. And with that, Chet waved so long and walked across the street. A few minutes later, I saw Bryce coming down the sidewalk toward his house. I did a double take. All this time, I'd thought he was inside the house watching, and he was really outside walking around. I was embarrassed all over again. I turned my back on him and concentrated on watering the yard. What a fool I was. What a complete idiot. And I had just built up a nice head of angry steam when I heard,
"It's looking good, Julie. Nice job."
It was Bryce, standing right there on our driveway. And suddenly I wasn't mad at me anymore. I was mad at him. How could he stand there like my supervisor and tell me, "Nice job"? He had no business saying anything after what he'd done. I was about to hose him down when he said,
"I'm sorry for what I did, Julie. It was, you know, wrong."
I looked at him, into those brilliant blue eyes. And I tried to do what Chet had said. I tried to look past them. What was behind them? What was he thinking? Was he really sorry? Or was he just feeling bad about the things he'd said? It was like looking into the sun, though, and I had to turn away. I couldn't tell you what we talked about after that, except that he was nice to me, and he made me laugh. And after he left, I shut off the water and went inside feeling very, very strange. The rest of the evening, I bounced back and forth between upset and uneasy. The worst part being, I couldn't really put my finger on what exactly I was upset or uneasy about. Of course it was Bryce, but why wasn't I just mad? He'd been such a scoundrel. Or happy. Why wasn't I just happy? He'd come over to our house. He'd stood on our driveway. He'd said nice things. We'd laughed. But I wasn't mad or happy. And as I lay in bed trying to read, I realized that upset had been overshadowed by uneasy. I felt as though someone was watching me. I got so spooked I even got up and checked out the window, and in the closet, and under the bed, but still the feeling didn't go away. It took me until nearly midnight to understand what it was. It was me watching me.
Looming large and smelly. Sunday, I woke up feeling like I'd been sick with the flu. Like I'd had one of those bad, convoluted, unexplainable fever dreams. And what I figured out about bad, convoluted, unexplainable dreams of any kind is that you've just got to shake them off. Try to forget that they ever happened. I shook it off all right, and got out of bed early because I had eaten almost nothing the night before, and I was starving. But as I was trucking into the kitchen, I glanced into the family room and noticed that my dad was sacked out on the couch. This was not good. This was a sign of battle still in progress, and it made me feel like an invader in my own territory. He rolled over and kind of groaned, then curled up tighter under his skinny little quilt and muttered some pretty unfriendly-sounding stuff into his pillow. I beat it into the kitchen and poured myself a killer bowl of cornflakes, and I was about to drown it in milk when my mother comes waltzing in and snags it away from me. "You are going to wait, young man," she says. "This family is going to have Sunday breakfast together." "But I'm starving." "So are the rest of us. Now go. I'm making pancakes and you're taking a shower. Go." Like a shower is going to prevent imminent starvation. But I headed down to the bathroom and on my way, I noticed that the family room was empty. The quilt was folded and back on the armrest. The pillow was gone. It was like I'd imagined the whole thing. At breakfast, my father didn't look like he'd spent the night on the couch. No bags under his eyes, no whiskers on his chin. He was decked out in tennis shorts and a lavender polo shirt, and his hair was all blown dry like it was a work day. Personally, I thought the shirt looked kind of girly, but my mom said, "You look very nice this morning, Rick." My father just eyed her suspiciously. Then my grandfather came in saying, "Patsy, the house smells wonderful. Good morning, Rick. Hi there, Bryce." And winked at me as he sat down and put his napkin in his lap. "Lynetta," my mother sang out, "breakfast." My sister appeared in a triple X miniskirt and platform shoes with eyes that were definitely of the raccoon variety. My mother gasped, but then took a deep breath and said, "Good morning, honey. I thought you were going to church this morning with your friends." "I am," Lynetta scowled and sat down. Mom brought pancakes, fried eggs, and hash browns to the table. My father just sat there, stiff as a board for a minute, but finally he shook out his napkin and tucked it into his collar. "Well," my mother said as she sat down, "I have come up with a solution to our situation."
"Here it comes," my father muttered. But my mother gave him a glare that shut him down cold.
"The solution is," my mom said as she served herself some pancakes, "we're going to invite the bakers over for dinner." My father blurts out, "What?" Lynetta asks, "All of them?" I put in, "Are you serious?"
but my grandfather heaps on another fried egg and says, "That, Patsy, is a marvelous idea." "Thanks, Dad," she says with a smile, then tells Lynetta and me, "Of course I'm serious, and yes, if Julie and the boys want to come, they'll be invited." My sister starts cracking up. "Do you know what you're saying?" Mom smooths the napkin into her lap. "Maybe it's about time I found out." Lynetta turns to me and says, "She's inviting the core of piss poor over for dinner. Oh, this is something I really woke up expecting." My father shakes his head and says, "Patsy, what purpose does this serve? So I made some stupid cracks last night. Is this the next phase in my punishment?" "It is something we should have done years ago." "Patsy, please, I know you feel bad about what you found out, but an awkward dinner party isn't going to change anything." My mother ran syrup all over her pancakes, popped the top close, licked her finger, then locked eyes with my dad. "We are having the bakers over for dinner." And that, she didn't have to tell him, was that. Dad took a deep breath, then sighed and said, "Whatever you want, Patsy, just don't say I didn't warn you." He took a bite of hash browns and mumbled, "A barbecue, I suppose?" "No, Rick, a sit-down dinner, like we have when your clients come over." He stopped chewing. "You're expecting them to dress up?" Mom glared at him. "What I'm expecting is for you to behave like the gentleman I always thought you were." Dad went back to his potatoes. Definitely safer than arguing with Mom. Lynetta wound up eating the entire white of a fried egg and almost a whole pancake besides. Plain, of course, but from the way she was glutting and giggling as she ate, it was obvious that at least she was in a good mood. Granddad ate plenty, even for him, but I couldn't tell what he was thinking. He was back to looking more granite than human. Me? I'd started tuning into the fact that this dinner could be more than awkward. It could be trouble. Those rotten eggs were back from the grave, looming large and smelly right over my head. Sure, Granddad knew, but no one else in my family did. What if it came up at dinner? I'd be dead. Fried. Cluck-faced meat. Later, as I was brushing my teeth, I considered bribing Julie, getting her on board so that nobody brought up the subject of eggs. Or maybe I could sabotage the dinner somehow, make it not happen. Yeah, I could. I stopped myself and looked in the mirror. What kind of wimp was I anyway? I spit and headed back to find my mom. "What is it, honey?" she asked me as she wiped off the griddle. "You look worried." I double-checked to make sure my dad or Lynetta wasn't lurking around somewhere, then whispered, "Will you swear to secrecy?" She laughed. "I don't know about that." I just waited. "What can be," she said, then looked at me and stopped cleaning. "Oh, it is serious. Honey, what's wrong?" It had been ages since I'd voluntarily fessed up about something to my mom. It just didn't seem necessary anymore. I'd learned to deal with things on my own. At least, that's what I'd thought. Until now. She touched my arm and said, "Bryce, tell me. What is it?" I hopped up to sit on the counter, then took a deep breath and said, "It's about Julie's eggs."
"About her eggs?"
"Yeah. Remember that whole chicken hen salmonella disaster?"
"That was quite a while ago, but sure."
"Well, what you don't know is that Julie didn't bring eggs over just that once. She's been bringing them over every week. Or about that, anyway."
"She has? Why didn't I know about this?"
"Well, I was afraid Dad would get mad at me for not telling her we didn't want them. So I started intercepting them. I'd see her coming, get to her before she rang the bell, and then I'd toss them in the trash before anyone knew she'd been here."
"Oh, Bryce. Well, I kept thinking they'd stop. How long can a stupid chicken lay eggs?" But I take it they have stopped?
Yeah, as of last week. Because Julie caught me chucking a carton in the trash outside.
Oh dear.
Exactly.
So what did you tell her?
I looked down and mumbled.
I told her that we were afraid of salmonella poisoning because their yard was such a mess. She ran off crying, and the next thing I know, she's starting to fix up their yard.
Oh, Bryce.
Exactly.
She was dead quiet for a minute. Then very softly, she said,
Thank you for your honesty, Bryce. It does help to explain a lot.
She shook her head and said,
What that family must think of us, and got back to cleaning the griddle. All the more reason to have them over for dinner, if you ask me.
I whispered,
You're sworn to secrecy on this whole egg thing, right? I mean, Julie told Granddad so he knows, but I don't want this to spread to, you know, Dad.
She studied me a minute, then said,
Tell me you've learned your lesson, honey.
I have, Mom.
Okay, then.
I let out a big sigh of relief.
Thanks. Oh, and Bryce?
Yeah?
I'm very glad you told me about it.
She kissed me on the cheek, then smiled and said,
Now, didn't I hear you promise you'd mow the lawn today?
Right, I said, and headed outside to trim the turf. That evening, my mother announced that the Bakers would be over Friday night at 6 o'clock, that the menu included poached salmon, crab risotto, and fresh steamed vegetables, and that none of us had better weasel out of being there. My dad muttered that if we were really going to do this, it would be a whole lot better to barbecue, because at least that way he'd have something to do. But my mom positively smoked him with her eyes, and he dropped it. So, they were coming. And it made seeing Julie at school even more uncomfortable than usual. Not because she gushed about it or even waved and winked or something. No, she was back to avoiding me. She'd say hi if we happened to run into each other, but instead of being, like, right over my shoulder any time I looked, she was nowhere. She must have ducked out back doors and taken roundabout ways through campus. She was, I don't know, scarce. I found myself looking at her in class. The teacher'd be talking and all eyes would be up front, except mine. They kept wandering over to Julie. It was weird. One minute I'd be listening to the teacher, and the next I'd be completely tuned out, looking at Julie. It wasn't until Wednesday in math that I figured it out. With the way her hair fell back over her shoulders and her head was tilted, she looked like the picture in the paper. Not just like it. The angle was different, and the wind wasn't blowing through her hair. But she did look like the picture. A lot like the picture. Making that connection sent a chill down my spine, and I wondered, what was she thinking? Could she really be that interested in root derivations? Darla Tressler caught me watching, and man, she gave me the world's wickedest smile. If I didn't do something fast, this was going to spread like wildfire. So I squinted at her and whispered, There's a bee in her hair, stupid. Then pointed around in the air like, There it goes, see? Darla's neck whipped around, searching for the bee, and I straightened out my focus for the rest of the day. The last thing I needed was to be scorched by the likes of Darla Tressler. That night, I was doing my homework, and just to prove to myself that I'd been wrong, I pulled that newspaper article out of my trash can. And as I'm flipping it over, I'm telling myself, it's a distortion of reality. It's my imagination. She doesn't really look like that. But there she was. The girl in my math class. Two rows over and one seat up, glowing through newsprint. Lynetta barged in. I need your sharpener, she said. I slammed my binder closed over the paper and said, You're supposed to knock! And then, since she was zooming in and the paper was still sticking out, I crammed the binder into my backpack as fast as I could. What are you trying to hide there, baby brother? Nothing.
and stop calling me that. And don't barge into my room anymore. Give me your sharpener and I'm history, she said with her hand out. I dug it out of my drawer and tossed it at her. And sure enough, she disappeared. But 2 seconds later, my mom was calling for me. And after that, well, I forgot that the paper was in my binder. Until first period the next morning, that is. Man, what was I supposed to do with it? I couldn't get up and throw it out. Garrett was right there. Besides that, Darla Tressler's in that class, and I could tell she was keeping an eye out for wayward bees. If she caught wind of this, I'd be the one stung. Then Garrett reaches over to snag a piece of paper like he does about 14 times a day, only I have a complete mental spaz and slam down on his hand with mine. Dude, he says, what's your problem? Sorry, I say, tuning into the fact that he was only going for lined paper, not newspaper. Dude, he says again, you know, you've been really spaced lately. Anyone else tell you that? He rips a piece of paper out of my binder, then notices the edges of the newspaper. He eyes me, and before I can stop him, he whips it out. I pounce on him and tear it out of his hands, but it's too late. He's seen her picture. Before he can say a word, I get in his face and say, you shut up, you hear me? This is not what you think. Whoa, kick back, will ya? I wasn't thinking anything. But I could see the little gears go click, click, click in his brain. Then he smirks at me and says, I'm sure you've got a perfectly reasonable explanation for why you're carrying a picture of Julie Baker around with you. The way he said it scared me, like he was playing with the idea of roasting me in front of the whole class. I leaned over and said, zip it, would you? The teacher hammered on us to be quiet, but it didn't stop Garrett from smirking at me or doing the double eyebrow wiggle in the direction of my binder. After class, Darla tried to act all cool and preoccupied, but she had her radar up and pointed our way. She shadowed me practically all day, so there was no real window of opportunity to explain things to Garrett. What was I going to tell him anyway? That the paper was in my binder because I was trying to hide it from my sister? That would help. Besides, I didn't want to make up some lame lie about it. I actually wanted to talk to Garrett. I mean, he was my friend. And a lot had happened in the last couple of months that was weighing on me. I thought that if I talked to him, maybe he'd help get me back on track, help me to stop thinking about everything. Garrett was real reliable in that arena. Luckily, in social studies, our class got library time to do research for our famous historical figure report. Darla and Julie were both in that class, but I managed to drag Garrett into a back corner of the library without either of them noticing. And the minute we were by ourselves, I found myself laying into Garrett about chickens. He shakes his head at me and says, dude, what are you talking about? Remember when we went and looked over her fence? Back in the 6th grade? Yeah. Remember how you were down on me for wondering what a hen was? He rolled his eyes. Not this again. Man, you didn't know jack diddly squat about chickens. I put my life in your hands and you dumped me in a bucket of bull. So I told him about my dad and the eggs and salmonella and how I'd been intercepting eggs for nearly 2 years. He just shrugged and said, makes sense to me. Man, she caught me. Who? Julie. Whoa, dude. I told him about what I'd said. And how almost right after that, she was out playing Weed Warrior in her front yard. Well, so? It's not your fault her yard's a mess. But then I found out that they don't even own that house. They're all poor because her dad's got a retarded brother that they're, you know, paying for. Garrett gives me a real chumpy grin and says, a retard? Well, that explains a lot, doesn't it? I couldn't believe my ears. What? You know, he says, still grinning, about Julie. My heart started pounding, and my hands clenched up, and for the first time since I'd learned to dive away from trouble, I wanted to deck somebody. But we were in the library, And besides, it flashed through my mind that if I decked him for what he'd said, he'd turn around and tell everyone that I was hot for Julie Baker, and I was not hot for Julie Baker. So I made myself laugh and say, "Oh, right," and then came up with an excuse to put some distance between him and me. After school, Garrett asked me to come to his house and hang for a while, but I had zero interest in that. I still wanted to slug him. I tried to talk myself down from feeling that way, but in my gut I was flaming mad at the guy. He'd crossed the line, man. He'd crossed it big time. And what made the whole thing so stinking hard to ignore was the fact that standing right next to him on the other side of the line was my father.
The visit. Sunday mornings are peaceful in our house. My father lets himself sleep in. My mother lets herself not fix breakfast. And if my brothers have been out late playing with their band, you won't even know they're around until noon. Usually, I tiptoe out to collect eggs while everyone else is asleep, then spirit a bowl of Cheerios back to my room to have breakfast in bed and read. But that Sunday, after spending most of the night feeling upset or uneasy, I woke up wanting to do something physical, to shake off the confused way I was still feeling. What I really needed was a good climb in my sycamore tree. But I settled for watering the lawn while I tried to think of other things. I cranked open the spigot and admired how rich and black the dirt looked as I sprinkled back and forth across the soil. And I was busy talking to my buried seedlings, coaxing them to spring up and greet the rising sun, when my father came outside. His hair was damp from a shower, and he had a grocery sack rolled closed in his hand. "Dad, I'm sorry if I woke you."
"You didn't, sweetheart. I've been up for a while."
"You're not going to work, are you?"
"No, I..."
He studied me for a moment, then said,
"I'm going to visit David."
"Uncle David?" He walked toward his truck, saying,
"That's right. I should be back around noon."
"But, Dad, why today? It's Sunday."
"I know, sweetheart, but it's a special Sunday."
I turned off the spigot. "Why's that?"
"It's his 40th birthday. I want to see him and deliver a gift,"
he said, as he held up the paper bag.
"Don't worry. I'll rustle us up some pancakes for lunch, all right?"
"I'm coming with you," I said, and tossed the hose aside. I wasn't even really dressed. I'd just pulled on some sweats and sneakers, no socks. But in my mind, there was no doubt. I was going.
"Why don't you stay home and enjoy the morning with your mother? I'm sure she would..."
I went over to the passenger side of his truck and said, "I'm coming." Then climbed inside and slammed the door back in place.
"But..."
he said through the driver's door. "I'm coming, Dad." He studied me a moment, then said,
"Okay,"
and put the bag on the bench seat.
"Let me leave a note for your mother."
While he was inside, I strapped on the lap belt and told myself that this was good. This was something I should have done years ago. Uncle David was part of the family, part of my father, part of me. It was about time I got to know him. I studied the paper sack sitting next to me. What was my father bringing his brother for his 40th birthday? I picked it up. It wasn't a painting. It was much too light for that. Plus, it made a strange, muted rattling noise when I shook it. I was just unrolling the top to peek inside when my father came back through the front door. I dropped the sack and straightened up, and when he slid behind the wheel, I said, "It's okay with you, isn't it?" He just looked at me, his hand on the key in the ignition. I'm not ruining your day with him or anything, am I?" He cranked the motor and said,
"No, sweetheart. I'm glad you're coming."
We didn't say much to each other on the drive over to Greenhaven. He seemed to want to look at the scenery, and I had a lot of questions, but none I wanted to ask. It was nice, though, riding with my father. It was like the silence connected us in a way that explanations never could. When we arrived at Greenhaven, my father parked the truck, but we didn't get out right away.
It takes some getting used to, Juliana, but it does grow on you. They grow on you. They're all good people.
I nodded, but felt oddly afraid.
Come on then,
he said, taking the sack from the seat.
Let's go inside.
Greenhaven didn't look like any kind of hospital to me. But it didn't look quite like a house either. It was too long and rectangular for that. The walkway had a faded green awning that covered it, and flower beds alongside with freshly planted pansies that looked muddied and slightly askew. The grass was patchy, with three deep holes dug near the building.
The residents tend the grounds,
my father said.
It's part of their occupational training program, and it's therapeutic. Those holes are the future homes of peach, plum, and pear.
Fruit trees?
Yes. The vote caused quite a commotion.
Among the residents?
That's right.
He swung open one of the glass double doors and said,
Come on in.
It was cool inside, and it smelled of pine cleaner and bleach with something vaguely pungent underneath. There wasn't a reception desk or waiting area, just a large intersection with white walls and narrow wooden benches. To the left was a big room with a television and several rows of plastic chairs. To the right were open office doors, and beside us were two pine armoires. One was open, with half a dozen gray sweaters hung neatly in a row.
Good morning, Robert, a woman called through one of the office doors.
Good morning, Josie,
my father replied. She came out to meet us, saying, David's up and about, has been since around six. Mabel tells me it's his birthday today.
Mabel is right again.
He turned to me and smiled.
Josie, it's my pleasure to introduce my daughter, Juliana. Juliana, meet Josie Gruenmacher.
Well now, isn't this nice? Josie said, clasping my hand. I recognize you from David's photo album. You're getting ready to graduate into high school, isn't that right?
I blinked at her, then looked at my dad. I'd never really thought of it that way, but I could see that he had. Yes, I suppose I am.
Josie's the site administrator.
And, Josie added with a laugh, I'm not graduating to nowhere. Been here 17 years and I'm staying put.
The phone rang and she hurried off saying,
Gotta get that. I'll meet up with you in a bit. Check the rec room, then his room. You'll find him.
My dad led me around a corner, and as we proceeded down a hallway, the underlying pungent part of the smell got stronger, like the place had had years of mystery pissers, with no one quite neutralizing what had been tagged. Down the hall was a small person hunched in a wheelchair. At first I thought it was a child, but as we approached, I could see it was a woman. She had almost no hair, and as she gave my dad a toothless smile, she grabbed his hand and spoke. My heart bottomed out. The sounds she made were choked and lost on her tongue. Nothing she said was intelligible, yet she looked at my father with such intensity, like of course he understood what she was saying. To my complete surprise, he said,
You're absolutely right, Mabel. It is today, which is why I'm here.
He held up the grocery sack and whispered, I've brought him a little gift.
Gwaal, she said.
How'd you know?
She gurgled at him until he patted her hand and said,
I'm much too predictable, I'm afraid. But he enjoys them and...
He noticed her gaze shift in my direction.
Hoo-ha, she said.
This is my daughter, Juliana. Juliana, I'd like you to meet the extraordinary Miss Mabel. She can remember everyone's birthday. And she has a real passion for strawberry milkshakes.
I managed a smile and whispered, Nice to meet you. But all I got in return was a suspicious scowl.
Well, we're off to David's,
my father said, then shook the bag.
Don't spill the beans if he happens by.
I followed him to a bedroom doorway, where he stopped and called,
David? David, it's Robert.
A man appeared at the door.
A man I would never have picked out as my father's brother.
He was stocky, with thick brown glasses, and his face looked puffy and pale. But he threw his arms around my father's chest and cried,
Robert, you're here.
Yes, I am, little brother.
I followed them into the room and saw that the walls were covered in a collage of puzzles. They'd been glued directly to the walls and even up on the ceiling. It was cozy and comfortable and interesting. I felt as though I'd entered a quilted cave. My father held his brother at arm's length and said,
And look who I've brought along.
For a split second, David looked almost frightened, but then my father said,
It's my daughter, Juliana.
David's face broke into a smile.
Juliana,
he cried, then practically tackled me with a hug. I thought I was going to suffocate. My face was buried as he squeezed the air out of me and rocked from side to side. Then, with a giggle, he let go and flopped into a chair.
Is my birthday.
I know, Uncle David. Happy birthday. He giggled again.
Thank you. We brought you a present,
my dad said as he opened the paper sack. Before he had it out, before I saw the actual size, I remembered the sound it had made when I'd shaken it in the truck. Of course, I thought. A puzzle. Uncle David guessed it, too.
A pole? Not just a puzzle,
my dad said as he pulled it out of the sack.
A puzzle and a pinwheel.
Dad had wrapped the puzzle box up in pretty blue paper and had taped the red and yellow pinwheel on as a bow. Uncle David snatched the pinwheel right off and blew, first gently, then fiercely in great spitty bursts.
Orange!
He cried between blows.
Orange!
Very gently, Dad took it from him and smiled.
Red and yellow do make orange, don't they?
David tried to grab it back, but my father said,
We'll take it outside later. The wind will blow it for you.
And pressed the puzzle back in his hands. As the wrapping paper fell in shreds on the floor, I leaned in to see what sort of puzzle my father had bought him, and gasped. 3,000 pieces. And the image was simply white clouds and blue sky. No shading, no trees, nothing but the clouds and the sky. My father pointed to a spot in the center of the ceiling.
I thought it would fit just right over there.
Uncle David looked up and nodded, then lunged for his pinwheel and said,
Outside? Sure, let's go out for a walk. Feel like going down to McElliott's for a birthday ice cream?
Uncle David's head bobbed up and down.
Yeah!
We checked out through Josie, then headed down the street. David can't walk very fast because his body seems to want to move inward instead of forward. His feet pigeon-toe and his shoulders hunch in, and he seemed to lean on my father pretty heavily as we moved along. But he kept that pinwheel in front of him, watching it spin, crying every now and then,
Orange! Orange!
McElliott's turned out to be a drugstore with an ice cream parlor inside. There was a red and white striped awning over the ice cream counter, and there were little white tables and chairs set in an area with red and white striped wallpaper. It was very festive looking, especially for being inside a drugstore. Dad got us all cones, and once we were sitting down, Dad and David did talk to each other some, but mostly David wanted to eat his chocolate fudge swirl. My father smiled at me from time to time, and I smiled back. But I felt disconnected. How many times had the two of them come here for ice cream? How many birthdays had my father celebrated with his brother like this? How long had he known Mabel and Josie and the rest of the people at Greenhaven? How could it be that in all these years, I'd never spent any time with my uncle? It was like my father had a secret life away from me. A complete family away from me. I didn't like it. Didn't understand it. And I was getting myself pretty worked up about it when David's cone crushed in his grip, causing his ice cream to flop onto the table. Before my dad